Hey there, and welcome back to the Deep Dive. We're jumping straight into a subject today that definitely has real-world impact for, well, all of us. Recent updates to the laws around offenses against persons and property. We've got this stack of source material here, notes, summaries. Looks like they're drawn right from legislative changes, really focusing in on this area.
Right. Lots to get through.
Exactly. And our mission for this deep dive is pretty straightforward, but I think really essential. We're going to unpack these sources together, kind of dig out the most important bits, the key knowledge, and really try to make sense of what these changes actually mean in practice. So think of this as us helping you get quickly and hopefully thoroughly informed on some pretty significant legal updates. We want to explain them, you know, as if you're encountering them for the first time, even if you follow this stuff generally. Just break down the concepts clearly as they appear in these sources.
Makes sense.
And the range of changes we're going to cover today is actually pretty diverse, which is kind of interesting when you look at legislative output like this. You know, we'll be diving into everything from how long the state has to prosecute family violence cases to new rules about owning pets after an animal cruelty conviction.
Ah, right. I saw that one.
Yeah. And changes to like operating a boat while intoxicated if a child's bored. Updates on catalytic converter theft. That's a big one.
Huge problem lately. Yeah.
And even how the law is adapting to new tech and voyeurism cases and tackling things like street takeovers and drag racing.
So, quite a mix.
It really is.
Yeah, and looking closely at these updates, just based on what's in the sources here, it isn't just about understanding one specific law, right? It often points to broader things, you know, how society's shifting or maybe what persistent problems lawmakers are trying to get a handle on and how the legal rules are trying to keep up with things like technology or, you know, just changing behaviors. So our goal is definitely to pull clear insights from this material and highlight the so what. Why do these specific changes matter and how are they explained in the notes we've got?
Absolutely. It's about seeing the system's specific responses to things happening right now, based purely on the details in these sources. Okay, let's unpack the stack piece by piece and dive into the first set of updates.
Sounds good. Let's do it.
All right, kicking things off, we're looking at something pretty fundamental in criminal law, the statute of limitations. This is coming from the source material covering House Bill 467, and it's specifically focused on family violence offenses. So maybe for someone who's a bit new to this legal idea or just wants a quick refresher based on how the sources frame it, can we explain what a statute of limitations actually is?
Sure, yeah. And the source material, you know, by talking about extending the period, it kind of assumes, you know, the basics, but let's clarify simply. Imagine like a legal deadline. That's pretty much what a statute of limitations is in criminal cases.
Okay, a deadline.
Yeah. It's the maximum amount of time set by the law that the government specifically, you know, prosecutors has to formally file charges against someone after a crime is supposed to have happened.
So there's like a clock that starts ticking right when the crime occurs.
Exactly. That's a good way to put it. And once that clock runs out, you know, once the deadline passes, the government generally just loses the legal power to bring charges against that person for that specific crime. Doesn't matter what evidence they might find later.
Okay, that makes sense. But why does this clock even exist? I mean, the sources talk about changing it, which implies there are reasons it's usually there in the first place.
Right. Well, the thinking behind it is usually about fairness and also just practicality. Statutes of limitations, they're meant to provide some kind of finality, right? So people aren't living under the threat of prosecution forever, like years or decades after something happened.
I see.
And they also recognize that, you know, evidence gets old, it degrades. Witnesses forget things. It just becomes harder and harder to have a fair trial for both the prosecution and the defense as time goes on. But, and this is key to what the sources are showing us here, for certain crimes, like family violence, maybe those standard time limits don't quite fit the reality of how those crimes happen or get reported. And that leads to these kinds of legislative changes we're seeing.
Which brings us right to House Bill 467. The source material is really clear. This bill extends the statute of limitations specifically for family violence offenses. So let's break down those specific changes just based on the details in the notes. What's the update for the misdemeanor offenses involving family violence?
Okay, so the sources explicitly state that for misdemeanor offenses that involve family violence, and we're talking about things like, say, misdemeanor assault, if it's committed against a family member, or someone you live with, or someone in a dating relationship, you know, based on the legal definition.
Yeah.
The statute of limitations for those has been extended. It's now set at 3 years from the date the offense happened.
3 years for misdemeanors. That's longer than usual, right? Isn't the typical limit for most misdemeanors shorter?
It is, yeah. Typically, it's 2 years for most misdemeanors, so this is a noticeable extension for this specific category.
Okay.
And the change isn't just for misdemeanors. The source material also points out that the time limit for a specific type of felony, the offense of continuous violence against a family, that's also been extended by this same bill.
Continuous violence against the family. Okay, so that's a more serious charge, right? Usually involves like a pattern of assaults over time within a family or relationship.
Exactly. It involves proving multiple instances of assault against a family member within a certain period. It's a felony charge reflecting that pattern.
So what's the new duration for those felony cases, according to the sources?
For those felony offenses, continuous violence against the family, the sources say the statute of limitations is now 5 years.
5 years. Wow. Okay, so 3 years for the misdemeanors, 5 years for this specific felony. Both pushed back quite a bit. Looking at the source material and the context it gives, what's particularly interesting or, you know, insightful about this extension, specifically targeting family violence? What does it suggest the legislature was thinking?
Well, what's really fascinating here, and you can kind of read between the lines in the source material, is how it seems to be a direct response to the unique challenges with these kinds of crimes.
Mm-hmm.
Family violence, I mean, by its very nature, it usually happens behind closed doors, right?
Mm-hmm.
It involves these really complex relationships, power imbalances, maybe financial dependence, fear, manipulation, you know, those cycles of abuse we hear about.
Right. It's not straightforward.
Not at all. And because of all that, victims often don't feel safe, or maybe they just aren't able to report the crime right away. They might be scared of retaliation, worried about kids, or maybe just struggling to process what's happening or gather the resources to leave a report.
That makes sense.
So the sources, by showing this extension, they're implicitly saying, look, we recognize it can take victims a long time, maybe months, maybe even years, to get to a place where they feel safe or strong enough to come forward and tell law enforcement.
Mm-hmm.
A 3-year window for misdemeanors or 5 years for these continuous violence felonies, that gives crucial extra time.
Yeah.
It allows for justice even if the report is delayed. It gives more time for maybe a victim to escape, find support, or maybe for other evidence to come to light that wasn't there right at the beginning.
That really does highlight how the law seems to be trying to adjust to the, well, the difficult realities of these situations. It feels less like just a standard legal clock and more like recognizing the victim's timeline.
I think that's a good way to put it.
So what are the practical implications then for the legal system or maybe for people affected by this?
Well, the most direct impact, and the source material points right to this, is that law enforcement and prosecutors now have a longer runway, essentially.
Right.
Up to 3 or 5 years, depending on the charge, where they can legally start a prosecution for these specific family violence crimes.
Okay.
So cases that maybe before would have hit that 2-year wall for misdemeanors, for example, and maybe got dropped or just couldn't be pursued, those might now be viable. And this brings up an important question, one the sources kind of make us think about indirectly. How might this longer timeline affect reporting rates down the road?
Mm.
Could knowing they have more time actually empower more victims to eventually come forward? And how does it change things for investigators? Maybe they have more time now to build a stronger case, gather more evidence, find corroboration.
Yeah.
It's definitely a change aimed at tackling some of those built-in problems and holding abusers accountable, recognizing that the standard clock just might not work for these particular crimes.
It's a really significant adjustment to that legal clock for very specific, very human reasons. Okay, let's shift gears now. Moving from dynamics within, you know, personal relationships, let's talk about our relationship with animals, specifically when cruelty is involved.
Okay.
The sources bring up a new law here, House Bill 598. And this seems designed to stop people convicted of certain animal cruelty offenses from just going out and getting new pets right away.
Okay.
Sounds logical, but the source material seems pretty specific about when this ban actually applies.
That's right. The core change here, as the source lays it out, is creating this legal ban on owning pets for a set amount of time.
Yeah.
But it's triggered only by a conviction for specific serious animal cruelty crimes.
Okay. And the sources are clear. It's not just any animal-related conviction, right? Mm-hmm. It's targeted. Which specific offenses trigger this ban, according to the notes?
Yeah, it's definitely targeted. The source specifies that the ban applies after a conviction for certain offenses. It gives examples like referencing the penal code sections for dogfighting, which is section 42.0, or cruelty to non-livestock animals, section 42.092. So it's aimed at what most people would consider the more severe acts of abuse or fighting.
Got it. And even getting convicted of one of those isn't automatically enough for the ban, based on these notes. There are specific conditions that have to be met.
Exactly. This is a really key point from the source material. The pet ownership ban only kicks in if one of two conditions is met when the crime was committed. Condition one, the actual conduct, the thing they did that led to the conviction, must have resulted in serious bodily injury or the death of an animal.
Okay, so serious harm or death. What's the other condition?
Or condition two, the person already has a previous conviction for one of these specific types of animal cruelty offenses.
Ah, okay. So it's either about the severity of the harm in this instance or the fact that they're a repeat offender for these particular crimes. Makes sense.
Precisely. It's focused.
And if one of those conditions is met, how long does this pet ownership ban last?
The sources state the ban lasts for 5 years.
5 years. Okay, so for 5 years after that conviction, if it involved serious harm or they were a repeat offender, they legally cannot own a pet.
That's the rule outlined in the source.
What's your take on this specific approach based on the sources? Targeting severe outcomes or repeat offenders with a 5-year ban like this?
Well, this measure, as it's described in the source material, It really shows a clear legislative move beyond just punishing the past act. It's actively trying to prevent future harm. By putting this ownership ban in place, the law is directly addressing the risk of, you know, recidivism, the person doing it again, for individuals who've shown they're capable of really severe animal cruelty or who keep engaging in these specific harmful acts. And what really stands out, like you pointed out, is how specific the triggers are. It's not for, say, less severe neglect cases. It's specifically for those resulting in serious injury or death, or for people who have a record of these serious offenses already. It suggests a focus on the individuals who are seen as posing the biggest ongoing risk to animals. It's really a preventative tool, trying to protect future potential animal victims by cutting off access for known abusers for a significant chunk of time.
And what about the implications for enforcement or for the people convicted?
Well, on the enforcement side, it means courts and law enforcement will need ways to track these specific convictions and then, you know, actually enforce the 5-year ban if someone tries to get a pet anyway.
Right. How do you even track that?
That's a practical challenge, definitely. For the individuals convicted under these conditions, it's a very direct and significant consequence being legally barred from owning pets for 5 years. It gives authorities a concrete tool right there in the source material to protect animals from people with a proven history of causing severe harm, instead of just waiting for another offense to happen.
Yeah, it feels like a direct answer to that concern people have, that abusers just move on to the next animal. Okay, let's shift gears again. From land and animals, let's head out onto the water.
Okay, boating.
Yep. The source material brings up a pretty significant change related to operating a watercraft while intoxicated BWI, especially when kids are involved. The notes show a clear increase in penalties here.
Yeah, this is an area where the legislature, as the sources detail it, has really ramped up the potential legal consequences for a specific dangerous behavior on the water, particularly with vulnerable passengers.
So the source material tells us what the situation used to be for BWI with a child passenger. What was the classification before this new law kicked in?
According to the notes we have here, previously, operating a watercraft while intoxicated with a child passenger on board was classified as a Class A misdemeanor.
Okay, and just so we're clear for anyone maybe not super familiar with these classifications, a Class A misdemeanor, that's serious, right? It's the highest level misdemeanor. Can mean jail time, big fines, but it's still generally less severe than a felony.
That's exactly right. Class A is definitely serious, top-tier misdemeanor, but it doesn't carry the same potential prison time or, you know, the lifelong consequences that come with being convicted of a felony.
Right. So it was already serious, but House Bill 1163, as described in these sources, changed that quite dramatically. What's the new elevated offense now, and what's its classification when a child is a passenger during a BWI?
So the new law, HB 1163, elevates the offense specifically when you're operating a watercraft while intoxicated, and you have a passenger younger than 15 years old.
Under 15, okay.
Right. The source states that this specific act is now classified as a state jail felony.
State jail felony, okay. That definitely sounds like a big jump from Class A misdemeanor. Can you break down what a state jail felony is, especially compared to a Class A misdemeanor, just based on what these source summaries might typically convey?
Sure. So a state jail felony is a specific category within the felony system. While the time served is usually in a state jail facility, not like a major state prison sentences can range from 180 days up to 2 years in state jail.
Okay.
The really critical difference is that it is a felony conviction.
Right. It crosses that line.
Exactly. And that's fundamentally different from any misdemeanor. A felony conviction brings much heavier long-term consequences. It can affect your right to vote, your right to own a gun, job opportunities, professional licenses, lots of things. Mm-hmm. So making that jump from a serious misdemeanor to any kind of felony, even a state jail felony, is a really substantial increase in how serious the offense is viewed and the potential lifelong impact on the person convicted.
So yeah, going from a serious misdemeanor to a felony that could mean actual state jail time, that's a really significant boost in potential consequences for doing this on the water. And this is where the source material gives us some really helpful insight. It explicitly tells us the reason for this change.
Yes. The notes here are quite clear about the legislative intent, which is great for understanding the why. The source says this change aligns BWI penalties more closely with DWI penalties involving child passengers. That seems to be the key rationale, according to this material.
Okay. Aligns BWI penalties more closely with DWI penalties.
Right. So what that tells us, pulling it straight from the source, is that the legislature looked at how we already treat drunk driving on the road when a child is in the car. Driving, while intoxicated with a child passenger, is typically already a state jail felony. And they made a conscious choice to apply a similar level of seriousness to doing the same kind of thing, but on the water. It shows a policy goal, really, to treat impaired operation of vehicles, whether it's a car or a boat, with similar gravity when young, vulnerable passengers are put at risk. It highlights a consistent focus on child safety, regardless of whether you're on land or water.
That explanation from the source really clarifies the intent. They want the consequences for endangering a child by operating impaired to be basically the same, car or boat.
Seems to be the clear message.
So what are the practical implications for boaters then?
Well, the implications are pretty significant for anyone operating a boat, especially if they might ever consider doing it after drinking or using drugs while having a child under 15 with them.
Mm.
The potential consequences have just gone way up.
Yeah.
What might have been a misdemeanor conviction before could now land you with a state jail felony conviction.
Yeah.
And that comes with potential state jail time, bigger fines, and that permanent mark of a felony record.
Mm.
It sends a really strong, clear message about how seriously the authorities are going to treat impaired boating when kids are involved. It elevates it to the same level of danger and legal consequence as DWI with a child, giving police and prosecutors the tools to pursue felony charges in these situations, just as the source material outlines.
A definite increase in severity aims squarely at protecting kids. Okay, let's shift gears again. We're moving now into an area that the source material itself flags as potentially complex, noting it might need expert consultation beyond just these summaries. This is about illegal voting.
Right. Election law can get intricate pretty quickly.
Yeah, and the sources mention changes around illegal voting, but they seem quite careful in how they phrase it, acknowledging that complexity. The material we have doesn't dive into every single detail, but it definitely points this out as an important area of recent legislative focus.
Yes. The caution in the source material here is noticeable. It emphasizes needing detailed understanding, maybe expert guidance, which itself tells you something about how deep or potentially complicated the actual laws might be.
So based only on what the source material actually says about legislation like Senate Bill 2 and maybe others, what was the apparent goal or result of these changes related to illegal voting?
Okay, sticking strictly to the source. It states that Senate Bill 2, which apparently passed during a special session, and other related laws, were aimed at clarifying and potentially increasing penalties for certain violations of the election code. And it specifically includes those offenses that fall under the umbrella of illegal voting.
Clarify and potentially increase penalties. That seems to be the core summary the sources give us regarding the intent and effect.
That's the language used, yes.
And the source definitely underlines the complexity involved.
Absolutely. The source material explicitly adds a note saying the specifics can be complex. It suggests that talking to election officials or legal experts like prosecutors might be needed for a full picture. It also mentions, interestingly, that law enforcement officers are told to know their agency's specific role, if they have one, in dealing with these offenses. That highlights the practical side, even if the nitty-gritty isn't spelled out in the summary.
Okay. What's your analysis then, just based on what the source material does tell us about this? Given that the details aren't fully laid out, what can we still take away from how the sources present this information?
Well, what's insightful here is maybe less about the specific changes, because, like the source says, we don't have all those details right here, and more about what the mention of these changes means, according to this material. The fact that SB2 and other laws are highlighted, with those stated goals of clarification and potential penalty increases, it tells us this whole area has been getting significant legislative attention lately.
Right, it's been a focus.
Exactly. And if you connect that to the broader context the source implies by talking about election code violations, it suggests lawmakers have been actively reviewing and tweaking the legal rules around, you know, election integrity and the voting process itself. The response, as described here, involves trying to make the rules clearer, maybe reducing confusion about what counts as illegal voting, and possibly making the consequences for breaking those rules more severe. And that note about officers needing to know their role, that just reinforces that these changes aren't just on paper. They have real-world implications for potential investigations and enforcement around elections. But again, we have to be really careful and stick only to what the source material gives us. It doesn't list which specific actions are now clearer or what the new penalties might be.
Right.
Only that these laws were passed with the aim to clarify and possibly increase them, based on this text. It flags it as a significant but complex area of recent legal updates.
So while the source material doesn't itemize the specific illegal voting acts or their new penalties for us, the main takeaway for you, the listener, straight from these sources, is that the rules and consequences around illegal voting have been reviewed and updated recently.
That's the core message, based solely on this source material. The legal landscape for illegal voting has been modified, with the stated goals of making things clearer and potentially tougher. And, as the source itself advises, you'd need to consult more detailed legal guides or officials for the full specifics beyond this high-level summary in our notes.
That's a crucial point, working strictly from the info provided.
Okay.
From potentially complex legal areas, let's move to a very, very tangible property crime, one that unfortunately has been all over the news and is a massive headache for car owners. Catalytic converter theft.
Oh, yes. A very current problem.
The sources make it really clear that this is a major issue, and they detail specific legislative action, mentioning House Bill 4110 and House Bill 2072, among others that directly target this.
Yeah, this is a perfect example of the legislature responding pretty directly and relatively quickly, it seems, to a specific, really widespread crime trend that's costing people and businesses a lot of money.
What is it about these specific parts that makes them such a hot target for thieves? The sources kind of hint at this by mentioning the market.
Right. As the source material implies by talking about metal recyclers, the issue is what's inside the catalytic converters. Mm-hmm. They contain valuable precious metals, platinum, palladium, rhodium.
Okay.
The prices for these metals have been pretty high, making the guts of a catalytic converter worth a decent amount on the scrap metal market. Thieves figured out they can often cut them off cars pretty quickly.
Yeah, I've heard it takes seconds sometimes.
Exactly. And historically, anyway, selling them for cash wasn't always that difficult. So strong incentive for theft right there.
So laws like HB 4110 and HB 2072 described in the sources are the counterattack, basically. What specific things do the sources say these bills do to fight this crime?
The sources say these bills tackle it by, one, enhancing penalties for the theft itself, and two, and this is important, by creating new specific offenses related just to catalytic converters, especially around possessing them illegally.
Let's focus on those new offenses and penalties the source material describes, particularly possession, because that's often where police might catch people involved, right, with the stolen goods.
Right, intercepting them after the theft.
So what are the new rules about possessing unlawfully removed catalytic converters?
Okay, the sources describe this tiered penalty system based on how many illegally removed converters someone has. If someone is caught possessing three or more unlawfully removed catalytic converters, the source states that crime is now classified as a state jail felony.
Three or more is a state jail felony. Okay, so having a larger number, which might suggest, you know, being involved in a bigger theft operation, bumps it up to a felony level. Similar to that BWI with a child passenger we just talked about.
Same felony classification, yes. State jail felony.
What about having fewer, like just one or two?
According to the sources, if someone has one or two unlawfully removed catalytic converters, that offense is classified as a Class A misdemeanor.
Okay, so even just having one or two illegally removed ones is still a serious misdemeanor, but three or more jumps it way up to a felony. Seems designed to hit different levels of involvement.
That appears to be the structure, yes.
The sources also mention another key area these laws target, involving the people who buy these stolen parts, right?
Yes, and this is really crucial because it goes after the market that fuels the theft in the first place. The laws described in the sources also strengthen record-keeping requirements for metal recyclers and other secondary metal buyers who purchase used catalytic converters.
How does that help?
Well, the idea is to make it much harder for thieves to just sell stolen converters anonymously for cash. It aims to create clear paper trails or digital trails for these transactions. That way, law enforcement can potentially use those records to trace stolen parts back and maybe build cases against not just the thieves selling them, but also any recyclers who are knowingly buying stolen goods.
Okay, I see. Hitting both sides. What's your analysis of this multi-pronged approach based on the sources? Hitting the thieves with possession penalties and hitting the market with these recycling rules.
Well, this approach, as the source material lays it out, it seems pretty comprehensive because it's attacking the crime from different angles simultaneously.
Yeah.
By creating those specific possession crimes with real teeth, state jail felony for 3 plus Class A misdemeanor for 1 or 2, the legislature is definitely increasing the risk for anyone caught with stolen converters, whether they sold them themselves or are just involved in moving them. And at the same time, by tightening up those record-keeping rules for recyclers, they're directly targeting the profit motive and the ease of selling these things illegally. The goal seems to be make it harder to sell stolen converters, make it harder for buyers to take them without leaving a trail, and make it easier for law enforcement to follow the money, so to speak. It does raise an interesting question, though, just looking at the source's description of this strategy. How effective will these tougher penalties and the new recycler rules actually be in disrupting the market and cutting down the number of thefts? Time will tell, I guess.
Yeah.
But it's definitely a strategic response trying to squeeze the whole operation from the theft and possession side to the selling and recycling side.
So the practical implications are higher risk for thieves and anyone handling stolen converters, and definitely more responsibility and scrutiny for the businesses buying these parts based on what these new laws mandate.
Exactly. The overall aim, you can infer from the combined actions described in the source, is to make catalytic converter theft a much less appealing and much riskier way to make a quick buck.
It's such a widespread problem. So yeah, a comprehensive response like this, hitting multiple points, seems logical. Okay, let's shift gears one more time. Moving from property crime involving cars to violations of privacy, specifically looking at voyeurism.
Okay, privacy issues.
The source material discusses updates to voyeurism laws, referencing House Bill 2306, and specifically mentioning it amends Penal Code Section 21.17. This update, as it's described, really seems like a direct response to how technology is changing the ways these kinds of privacy violations can happen.
This is another really clear example where the law is being explicitly updated, as the sources detail, just to make sure it covers the capabilities that modern tech offers, especially when those capabilities can be misused to invade privacy in new ways.
So what's the core update to the definition or the scope of the voyeurism law, according to the source material on HB 2306?
The fundamental update, as stated right in the source, is that the law now explicitly includes the use of electronic means within the definition of voyeurism.
Electronic means.
Yes. That's a critical clarification.
Mm-hmm.
It removes any potential gray area that might have existed before about certain kinds of surveillance tech.
And the sources even give specific examples of these electronic means that are now explicitly covered.
They do. The source material specifically calls out devices like drones or hidden cameras as examples of electronic means now explicitly covered by the voyeurism law.
Drones and hidden cameras. Okay.
These were probably added just to make absolutely sure there's no argument that using these kinds of modern tools for secret surveillance falls under the law.
So the law now clearly says using things like drones or hidden cameras can be voyeurism, but only under certain conditions, right? As detailed in the source.
Exactly. The source is careful to lay out the specific conditions that have to be met for using these electronic means to count as voyeurism under the updated law. It applies when these tools are used to surveil another person, but it has to meet these criteria. First, location. The surveillance has to happen in a private place or be aimed at the private areas of another person. Second, consent. It absolutely has to be done without their consent.
Right.
And third, the purpose. It has to be done for the specific purpose of sexual arousal or gratification.
Private place or private areas without consent and for sexual arousal or gratification.
Got it. That explicit inclusion of tech like drones feels really significant today.
Mm-hmm.
What's your analysis of why this update is important, just based on the nature of the change itself?
Well, what's really insightful here is how directly the legislature, as the source material shows, is plugging a gap created by technology just getting better and more accessible. Before this update, trying to prosecute someone for, say, using a drone to peep into a bedroom window or hiding a tiny camera somewhere private,
yeah.
It might have required lawyers to argue about how those actions fit into older legal definitions, maybe written before drones were common or cameras were so small. Was it legally surveillance or observation in the way the old law meant? There could have been loopholes or arguments.
Right. Ambiguity. Exactly. So this explicit inclusion, actually naming drones and hidden cameras, it just removes that doubt, according to the sources. It clarifies that, yes, using these modern tools for invasive spying is covered by the voyeurism law, as long as those conditions about privacy, consent, and purpose are met. And if you connect this to the bigger picture, it just highlights that constant challenge lawmakers have. Keeping the legal rules relevant in a world where technology changes so fast, especially tech that can easily violate privacy. This update gives clear legal grounds, as detailed right here in the source, for going after voyeurism done using modern electronic surveillance.
So it provides clearer legal tools for prosecutors and maybe stronger legal protection for individuals against these kinds of privacy invasions using specific technologies.
That's the essence of it. The implication is that police and DAs now have clearer definitions and tools for these cases involving drones or hidden cams. And for you, as an individual, it offers more explicit legal protection against these increasingly possible ways your privacy could be invaded. Less wiggle room for perpetrators to argue their high-tech spying wasn't covered by old laws. It's the law adapting, as the sources show, to a specific modern threat.
It is reassuring to see the law trying to keep pace with technology in such a targeted way. Okay, finally, let's look at recent laws aimed at cracking down on those disruptive and frankly dangerous activities that have become a real problem in some cities: street takeovers and drag racing.
Ah, yes. Another very visible issue lately.
The source material talks about House Bill 1442 and House Bill 2899, which tackle these activities. The notes highlight an expanded authority given to law enforcement through these bills.
Right. These bills, as the sources describe them, look like an effort by the legislature to give police more immediate and maybe more potent tools to discourage these things and break them up when they happen.
What's the specific new power granted to officers by these sources concerning the vehicles used in street takeovers and drag racing?
The core change, the big new authority described in the source material, is that officers may now impound a vehicle that was used in connection with these specific dangerous activities.
Impound the vehicle. So, Seize the car involved. And the sources connect this new power to specific activities defined in the penal code.
Yes. The sources are specific about what triggers this impoundment power. It applies to vehicles used in a drag racing offense, and it references Penal Code Section 49.09C, which defines what that crime involves. It also applies to vehicles used in a street takeover event. And here, the course references Penal Code Section 28.02, which deals with reckless damage or destruction. The source material explicitly links using the vehicle in a street takeover to this potential charge, suggesting the impoundment can happen based on participation in the takeover itself.
Okay, so if your car is used in illegal drag racing or one of these street takeover events, as the law defines them, it can be impounded. And there's a really crucial detail about this power highlighted in the source material, isn't there?
Yes, and this detail is key to understanding how broad this new authority is. It represents a potentially big shift. The sources explicitly state that impoundment is now allowed regardless of whether property damage or injury occurred.
Wow. So the car doesn't actually have to crash or hit anything or hurt anyone for it to be seized by the police. Just using it in that illegal drag race or street takeover is enough.
That's exactly what the source material indicates, and it's a really significant aspect of these new laws. Before, actions like impounding a car or maybe even forfeiture later on might have been more closely tied to the results of the dangerous driving, you know, the damage caused, the people injured.
Right.
By allowing impoundment based simply on the vehicle's use in a drag racing offense or a street takeover event, as defined by law, the legislature is giving police an immediate, direct way to penalize the participants and disrupt the whole event. The thinking behind it, you can infer from the law's structure, is to hit the individuals involved where it hurts by taking away the very tool they're using to commit the offense, their vehicle. It applies a real consequence, even if, just by luck, a particular event ends without a crash or obvious damage. The penalty focuses on participating in the inherently dangerous activity itself.
That definitely feels like it could be a powerful deterrent, hitting someone's car like that. What's your analysis of the potential impact of this new authority based on what the sources describe?
Well, it certainly gives law enforcement a very significant tool for responding to these events when they happen. I mean, arrests and other charges still apply, obviously, but the potential for immediate impoundment of your car. That could be a huge consequence, maybe even more impactful for some participants than a fine or even a short jail stay.
Yeah, losing your car is a big deal.
It removes the vehicle right then and there from the scene and from the owner's control. Makes it pretty hard to keep participating in that event, or maybe even get to future ones easily. It does raise an interesting question for you, the listener, to think about just based on this change. How effective do you think taking someone's car will be as a deterrent compared to other penalties like tickets or arrests? And how might this new power, as described in the source material, actually change the dynamics or how often these street takeovers and drag races happen? It's definitely a direct legislative response, giving police immediate, tangible action to disrupt things now and maybe deter them later by focusing the penalty right on the dangerous behavior itself, outcome aside.
We have definitely covered a lot of ground in this deep dive, all based on the source material you provided, ranging from really personal things inside the home to stuff happening on our waterways, hitting property crimes that affect so many people, and tackling these dangerous public activities on our streets.
Quite a range, yeah.
Yeah. Just to quickly recap what we've unpacked from this stack of sources. We looked at the statute of limitations extension for family violence misdemeanors up to 3 years, continuous violence felonies up to 5.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about that new 5-year pet ownership ban after certain severe or repeat animal cruelty convictions.
Right.
We saw boating while intoxicated with a child under 15 getting bumped up from a Class A misdemeanor to a state jail felony, aligning it with DWI.
Big change there.
We touched on the updates around illegal voting, like SB2, aiming to clarify rules and potentially increase penalties, though the source has noted the complexity.
Yep, the complex one.
We examined the tougher penalties for catalytic converter theft, creating those tiered possession offenses, Class A for 1 or 2, state jail felony for 3 or more, plus the tighter recycler rules.
The multi-pronged approach.
We reviewed the voyeurism law updates, explicitly including electronic means like drones and hidden cameras under specific conditions.
Catching up with tech.
And finally, we explored that new power for police to impound vehicles used in drag racing and street takeovers, even if no damage or injury occurs.
Taking the cars.
Looking at all these updates, just based purely on the sources we've gone through, we really get a clear picture of how the legal landscape is actively being shaped and updated right now. It shows lawmakers responding to different pressures, right? Specific crime waves like catalytic converters, technology like drones, ongoing societal concerns like child safety, or the challenges in family violence cases. This deep dive, using the material you provided, has really been about getting you quickly and clearly informed on these specific changes and the ideas behind them.
Absolutely. And seeing these specific changes laid out like this, as detailed in the sources, it gives you a valuable peek into the legislative process, what's getting prioritized, what tools are being used. It shows how laws are constantly being looked at, tweaked, adapted to try and address specific real-world problems the state is facing, based on the information and concerns that get brought forward. These aren't just, you know, abstract legal points on a page. They're practical changes. They have direct effects on individuals, on law enforcement, and just on how society tries to manage harmful behavior.
It really is fascinating how specific these legislative responses are when you break them down like this, pulling it right from the source notes. And that brings us to a final thought for you, the listener, to maybe chew on as you think about these updates. We've seen how these particular laws tackle very distinct problems, privacy versus technology, the economics driving theft, safety on roads and water, the realities of domestic abuse. But there's also kind of a common thread, isn't there? The legal system is constantly playing catch up or trying to get ahead of evolving harmful behaviors.
Always adapting or trying to.
So the question to consider is, what other areas of life, maybe things you encounter every day, might be facing similar challenges, where existing laws feel maybe a bit outdated or just not quite enough in the face of new technologies or new types of crime or just changing social dynamics? Where else might the law need to catch up, just like it seems to be doing in these areas we've explored today based on these sources?
That's a really compelling question to ponder. Staying informed on these legal shifts is definitely key to understanding the rules of the game, so to speak.
Indeed. Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into these recent legal updates covering offenses against persons and property, all drawn from the material you provided. We really hope this unpacking has been insightful and helped clarify these changes for you.
Keep exploring the sources around you. There's always more to learn.
And stay curious.